Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Keep your money local. Bring it home to a Wintrust Community Bank, home of Cubs checking with free ATMs nationwide. Find out more at Wintrust.com/Cubs. Member FDIC.
Let's play two.
Back!
Welcome to the Cubs Talk Podcast, presented by Wintrust Community Bank. I'm Luke Stuckmeyer. Boy, we had a lot of fun bringing you the Sandberg game podcast over the weekend, but there's a lot we had to leave out of my interview with Rhino, just trying to keep that podcast to about 30 minutes long. So, over the next two podcasts, we are bringing you all of that one-on-one interview with the Cubs Hall of Famer. We have some fun behind-the-scenes stories from it, starting with how Rhino landed his now-retired number 23 that flies on the right field foul pole at Wrigley. And by the way, speaking of Rhino, Miracle has come to Chicago. Miracle, the musical, inspired by the 2016 World Series champion Cubs that you love. It's hailed as a must-see show by the Hall of Famer. Miracle's at the Royal George Theater right now, and you can find tickets on Ticketmaster.com. All right, the curtain is up on Cubs Talk Podcast, part one of my conversation with Ryan Sandberg. Ryan, I want to start at a spot that is even before the Sandberg game and all the things that follow after it, but take me back to just the trade. You know, before that, you're traded to the Cubs. The Phillies have Mike Schmidt. They have you. They potentially have two Hall of Famers in their infield, but they decide to make the move. And how did you feel as a young player at that point?
Well, yeah, first of all, the Phillies did have Mike Schmidt. I was an infielder, I was a shortstop. So Mike Schmidt, Larry Boa, Manny Trio, who I admired for the 4 years I was in the Phillies system as being idols ahead of me. And, like, no way did I think that I'd come in and possibly bump one of those out of there, because back in that day, those teams were set for 10, 12, 15 years, and they stuck together. So they were there. They were going to be there in my eyes as a young player. So, of course, the trade happened with Dallas Green directing that, and he was the one that started watching me when I was 17 years old as a junior in high school in Washington State. He had scouts not only watch me in baseball, where we only played 16 games, so try and get a feel of a player in 16 baseball games, and half of those games were played in snow and sleet. So they'd watch me play basketball, football, and baseball, and they watched the whole my play all those three sports, and that's what they were looking for, was more of a all-around athlete. So Dallas Green with the trade, first reaction was, I was just there in September as a September call-up with the Phillies, and the Cubs were out of it. I think there was probably 2,500 fans at the three-game series, the Phillies against the Cubs.
Yeah.
And the Phillies had a good team. Cubs did not, and nobody was at the ballpark. So when I got wind that I was traded to the Cubs, I happened to be in Venezuela playing winter ball at the time, and got a phone call down there, you've been traded to the Cubs. And my first thought was, wait, there's 3,000 people there at this. It's an old ballpark. There's chain link fence in left field. There's houses in the outfield. That was my first thought. And they were struggling as an organization and with their team at that point. So those thoughts went through my head. That's where I was going.
So you'd already had your first look at Wrigley Field?
I did. My first look, a three-game series. It was a Philadelphia Philly September call-up. I actually got my first start at Wrigley Field. Second game of that series, there happened to be a doubleheader from a rainout from earlier on in the season. Dallas Green, the manager, came up to me and said, Sandy, you're going to play shortstop the second game of the doubleheader. So I said, okay. So I went immediately to Larry Boa because I didn't have any bats at that time. They hadn't showed up at the ballpark yet. This is the old times.
Yeah.
Now there's bats all over the place for a player that's coming up. So I didn't have a bat. So Larry said, pick one out. So I just picked a bat out, one of his bats, and went up and got four at bats that game. Played shortstop, second game of a doubleheader, and got my first base hit. Major leagues as a Philadelphia Philly at Wrigley Field, a base hit to right field off of Mike Kruko.
So maybe it was destiny you end up at Wrigley Field. How about 23? Where did the number 23 come from?
23 came from Yosh Kawano, the lifelong home clubhouse guy of the Cubs. I've been there 60 something years at the end, but at that point, 23 was hanging in my locker the next spring training. When I showed up and I looked at the and I looked saw number 23 and I said, what an odd number that is. I don't know anybody that wears 23. I couldn't think of any sport, football, basketball, or baseball, then that wore 23. It just seemed to be odd. 14, 12, 10, 16, 18. Those are like numbers that I could relate to growing up. And so nobody came to mind 23. So it was just. It was given to me by him, and there was a time when I made the club, my rookie season, where I went into Yosh before opening day and said, Yosh, I questioned about number 23. I said, that really doesn't feel like an infield number to me. I'm an infielder. And I said, in high school I wore number 14. And he said, well, 14's not available. And I had no idea why.
Right.
Of course, we know now Ernie Banks went up on the foul pole during my career. And so he said, you know what, son? You're going to wear number 23. Go out and make it a good number.
Well, you made it a great number. And that month of June in 1984, I started looking around. I was like, that's got to be one of the best 11-day stretches in Chicago baseball history. You had the Sutcliffe trade to the Cubs on June 13th. You had the Bulls draft Michael Jordan, another 23, obviously, on the 19th. And then your game, the Sandberg game, happens on the 23rd. So all three of those happen in less than a two-week span. But I thought it was really strange or maybe unique or cool that the Sandberg game happens on 23. Did you ever think about it back then?
No, but afterwards, when people would ask me about that game, I would never forget it because it was June 23rd. So it was perfect as far as remembering the date. First of all, but the other thing, I think Dennis Eckersley, that was his first game at Wrigley Field, and it was about Sutcliffe's, whatever you said, about 10 days into it.
Yeah, he made one start, I think.
So I just remember all that happening at once, and there's a lot that goes into that game. First of all, we're approaching the top for the first time. We were knocking at the door at first place. Now, whether we went in a half a game up or half a game out of first, it was something like that scenario. So it was a team where the Cubs were was a first in a number of years. That was the big thing. And so then the Cardinals were in town. And then we have the Saturday game of the week, which was a big deal. And then June. But really that day and that game, I've been asked by some players and people throughout the years, when did you really feel like you were a major league player? When was that? And they're thinking like little league, a T-ball, little league, high school, college. No, I didn't go to college. Minor league, had to be somewhere in there. And it was actually right after that game. It was my third year in the big leagues, and it was right after the June 23rd game where I said, you know what, I belong here. And it was just a week later when I catapulted and went ahead of Steve Sachs in the All-Star voting just the next week. So that nationally televised game got some national votes that had me start my first All-Star game, first of 10, and all that happened after June 23rd.
All in a row, first All-Star game, and then it was one after another at second base.
At second base, the All-Star Games, which was 10 straight. It was the start of 7 straight silver bats. That was my first silver bat. It was my second gold glove and MVP, all at 24 years old, all really happening, starting on June 23rd for the rest of that season. And with after that season, reflecting back at it and the postseason run, my goals were now not to just be in the major leagues, not continue to play second base for the Cubs. It was to try and win an MVP, try a silver bat, all-star, all those things that I'd won, and also get the Cubs to the postseason of World Series. All that was the goal from that point on after that, raising all my expectations for myself.
It all goes back to that one game at Wrigley Field, which you said was game of the week on NBC. There was, you couldn't see every game of every team like you can today. Back then, that game of the week was, as a kid growing up, I watched This Week in Baseball, and then you watched the game of the week. Did players know or feel it was a big deal when the game of the week was their game?
In the major leagues, they called it the game of the world because it was nationally televised. And besides the Cubs on WGN in the daytime and the Atlanta Braves at night, it was just the Saturday game of the week, and that was it. And there's normally an A game with Joe Garagiola and Vin Scully at the time. And then there was the B game, which in case of a rainout, and it was Bob Costas and Tony Kubek. We got word before the first pitch that we were the game of the week. The main game was rained out. So here's Bob Costas, Tony Kubek, and then we're going to be seen nationally on this Saturday game of the week. Now, myself growing up in Spokane, Washington, did not have Braves baseball, did not have TBS, did not have WGN. I had the Saturday game of the week, and that was it. And as a little kid, I wouldn't sit there and watch that for 3 hours. I'd watch a couple at-bats, run outside with the wiffle ball, throw the wiffle ball up in the air, emulate the right-handed hitters, the left-handed hitters, and then go in and watch some more and go back out. Maybe a buddy would show up then and we'd pitch. We were emulating the Saturday games of the week as a kid, and that was the only Major League Baseball games that I would ever see.
So you had 7 hits in the 2 games prior to that. Do you remember feeling good at the plate, or was it just another stretch in your major league career leading up to that point?
My son Justin was born early May, so I was actually player of the month in May. And I think the fact that he was born was such a walking on cloud 9 that I just went out and just saw the ball and hit it and just played and was actually player of the month, which back in those days was a big thing. Player of the week was big. I was player of the week in May, but then also player of the month. So that was the best player in the National League for the month of May, leading up to the June 23rd. So then the fact that you say that I was hot before that game, I thought I was hot for about a month and a half.
So you're before. Feeling...
So I'm feeling good.
Yeah.
Now, another side of it, about the entertainment side of baseball was introduced to me that day because the night before, Rick Sutcliffe lined up 8 tickets and 8 of us went to the Alabama concert, front row. We'd listened to their music because we had a lot of country western guys, and Sutcliffe was one of them, Jody Davis, Moreland. We listened to their music before the games leading up to that concert. So here I was in the front row, a little bit late night for me, out of my routine and what I normally get to bed at 9:30, 10 o'clock for a day game the next day. The concert was starting about 8:30. So this was a night well after midnight where I was home, now to bed, wake up the next day. But the thrill that I got from that concert and from them entertaining us was off the charts. Because country western band in person like Alabama, it was like a rock concert with the energy. And I just think the next day I went out and just played the game, and as it turned out, be the most entertaining, one of the most entertaining games that I had played for the audience. And so I kind of look back at that and never forgot that I got a boost from the band Alabama for that next day.
The band Alabama, if you would have told me
Randy
coming
Orange.
Into this, I would have never guessed Alabama. I would have thought, oh, he went to see Van Halen. It was 1984, it became the theme song for the 84 Cubs. You're telling me it was country music.
It was country, well, we mixed it up.
Yeah.
It was country music, but it was that
for
one
that game,
concert
it was
before that
music.
Game. It was the night before. It was the Friday night before that game that I experienced that. And then I just remembered, wow, you know, and then I played an entertaining game for the fans that very next day. I think that really rubbed off. So it's
so
pretty
if
ironic.
So if you had a walk-up
back.
Song today, it might have been an Alabama song. You know, guys now have walk-up songs. Back then, it was only Oregon.
Yeah, on the 84 field. Team, all those Alabama songs would have probably been taken up. So I would have probably went with some 80s rock, possibly Van Halen, maybe Styx or Journey, Foreigner, something like that.
Nice. So much fun hearing that Rhino tried to get a different number when he joined the team, but sorry, kid, 14 is taken by Mr. Cub. In Alabama, the concert that fueled a piece of Cubs history. Back to my conversation with Rhino in a second, but first, speaking of concerts, if you need tickets to a Cubs game or a concert somewhere this summer, make sure you check out our sponsor, SeatGeek. They have more than 50,000 five-star reviews in the App Store, and they make it just super easy for you. SeatGeek pulls in millions of tickets from around the web, then it rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10, then it displays them on an interactive map, so it's this simple to find what you're looking for. Green dots are good deals, red dots are overpriced deals. I've got the app on my phone, I use it all the time. It's by far the easiest way that I've found to buy tickets. For example, comedian Sebastian Maniscalco is coming to the United Center this fall. Went on SeatGeek, green dots everywhere, boom, done, tickets locked up. Here's the best part. Cubs Talk podcast listeners get $10 off their first ticket purchase on SeatGeek. They support our podcast. We hope you're going to support them. Use the promo code CUBSTALK, all one word, for $10 off on your first purchase. You can use that for concert tickets, Cubs tickets, comedy events, whatever you want. Maybe you want to see Alabama play just like Rhino. Speaking of that, let's pick up our conversation with the Cubs Hall of Famer. The game was just so different. We talked about the broadcast was different. Entertainment was different. I looked at the stats, and Bob Dernier had 27 stolen bases in June, and you turned out to be the MVP. You had 7 home runs in June coming into that. How different was the game at that point in baseball history?
The game,
just like the game of baseball.
The game of baseball.
Guys were stealing bases like crazy. It was more small ball than
In the '84 and the '80s. It was small ball. It was having a legitimate leadoff hitter get on and distract the pitcher and steal, oftentimes steal second base. Now is the next guy's job to advance him, at least to get him over to third, maybe to home. So as a number two hitter with a base stealer like Bob Dernier, I was a fastball hitter.
Right.
I played into that. That played into my strength of being a fastball hitter. Now we have a base stealer on base. You didn't have the slide steps. Pitchers really worked on their pickoff moves, and that was the defense for base stealing and maybe a pitch out. That was about it. But once the pitcher started home with his stretch, once his leg lifted and he was going home, and you could steal a base. So. Bobby D and myself, we just played with that. We were given the green light by Jim Fry to put on the hit and run anytime we wanted to ourselves. So I was actually giving signs to Bob Dernier, you're stealing or you're hitting and running. So I'd either lean over the plate and protect him and let him steal and get in the way of the catcher a little bit, or he'd get a jump and I'd get a fastball and I'd drive it, thinking right field primarily, yeah. Trying to get him to third base. Oftentimes, I was rewarded with a base hit going that way, and so that worked. And then the first and third happened, and we really played that strong. And then Harry Carey came up with called us the daily double, because we're on first and third and second and third, and we're on base a lot and creating havoc. We double steal, but that's the way that the game was played. And then once the guy would get him over to third base, the next guy get him in. So that we practiced in batting practice ourselves as groups, really led by Gary Matthews, who came over and took charge, almost like a coach, father figure coach on the field, batting in my group. Get him over, get him in. This is what we're going to do today. We got to stay back on this guy. We got to watch his breaking pitch. And that was my batting practice that whole year. Was pretty much led by Gary Matthews, who the Sarge, he did come in and really took charge.
So even Dallas Green added a lot of players to that team in the couple years and before and even that season. But you feel like Sarge was as big a piece as anybody?
Yeah, he was the glue part of it that got everybody together on the same page of winning a baseball game. It wasn't just showing up and just, okay, everybody just do their thing and take batting practice, and there's no rhyme or rhythm about it. There's no team about it. He brought the team together as teamwork to win a baseball game. And he was verbal with the pitchers. When when us as a regular players or hitters would get pitched up and in, you know, he would say something in the dugout, hey, somebody's got to go down right here or something. He took charge of all those things. That's how the game was played.
Yeah.
And the pitchers go out next inning and throw up and into somebody. They hit the dirt and okay, now we're fine. And then we just play until something else would come up. But he came from the Phillies. He was a hard-nosed player. He was a clean player, hard-nosed. Came from a winning team with the Phillies, and he brought that whole attitude to not only the Cubs, but very personable to me because we were hitting the same group, and I was on base ahead of him. So what he would say was, I was setting the table for him. So he wanted he wanted me on second base. He wanted me and Bobby D on first and third. He wanted second and third with him coming up as the three-hole hitter. That's what he wanted. Then he was in the clutch and hit, and he loved those situations about putting the pressure on the pitcher with the base runners, and now he's at the plate. So he was all about winning, and that's what he brought to us that year.
So June 23rd, you talked about Dernier and how the daily double kind of set the stage for the team. The first big thing that happens for you in that game is an RBI single after Dernier steals second base. And so that kind of sets the stage for what you guys were trying to do all year.
It does. The other thing that happened early in that game was I think we were down 7-0 with Steve Trout on the mound, which I see every year at Cubs convention, and Steve Trout takes a lot of credit for the Sandberg game because we're down 7-0 because he was the starting pitcher and he gets a kick. A kick out of that. I think he was out in the fourth inning. But, Bobby D gets on base. He steals. I got a base hit. That's what we had been doing. That's what we preached. We were also a never give up type of a team with the talking on the bench and the talking on the field that we had from the Boas and the Sarge. And it just filter on down with them, Sutcliffe. And there was always a lot of talk about hanging in there and chipping away. So like you mentioned, Bobby and I set the table there and got a run in, and that was part of about coming back.
That's a wrap for part one of our Ryan Sandberg conversation. Part two should drop sometime on Wednesday. The Cubs comeback is on, and Rhino is ready to introduce himself to America.
I was thinking of the whole day I think I had as I'm running the bases. I said, this whole day, I mean, I'm good for 2 weeks here for stats. I mean, this is great stuff.
Part two of our Sandberg sit-down Wednesday. Thanks for listening, and feel free to send us your feedback. Rate the Cubs Talk podcast on iTunes. I'm Luke Stuckmeyer. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, fly the W.